Abraham Lincoln, Chapter 8, Lonely Days in the White House. Fateful crossing of a threshold, the oath had committed the country to Lincoln's keeping, and he would carry the load even at the sacrifice of his own life. The people had chosen better than they knew, but let us see with what sort of welcome they cheered their leader, and what support they held out to make his burden less heavy. We are already aware that he was little known at the time of his nomination, that during the 4 months of the campaign which followed, he took no active part, so far as his countrymen could learn, in what was going on. We know that many thought that his speeches during the 2 weeks' journey to Washington just before his inauguration lacked boldness, vigor, and breadth, and failed to indicate a clear grasp of the perilous situation. To their minds, the man who had become the executive head of the nation was unfit for his great task. Such a feeling was not unnatural in those who did not know the man, for Abraham Lincoln had been brought up in the backwoods in the midst of poverty and ignorance. He himself said that he had never gone to school a year in his life. He was also untrained and untried. The only executive position he had ever held was that of postmaster in the little village of New Salem. Certainly the Republican Party was thrusting a rash experiment upon the country in making such a man the national leader in a time of so great a crisis. The country was on the verge of civil war. That Abraham Lincoln, the rail splitter and country lawyer, who had thus far been successful mainly as a clever politician and a stump speaker, was to become by his patience, courage, judgment, high purpose, unselfishness, and strength of will the successful leader of the nation through this great crisis, nobody could know. To his excited critics, it even appeared foolhardy in him to be willing to assume such a responsibility. Even in his own party, the majority of the political leaders held this view when he became president. They had not yet found out for themselves what a Southerner had said in February 1861, that Abraham Lincoln would do his own thinking. Nor did the members of his cabinet know him any better. Among these men who were to sit at his council table and advise him as what was wise to do were four men, Seward, Chase, Bates, and Cameron, who had been his rivals for the presidency. Some of his friends doubted the wisdom of his appointing so many men who had been his own rivals and rivals of one another. They predicted trouble in bringing about the harmonious action that was absolutely necessary. But Lincoln answered, "No, gentlemen, the times are too grave and perilous for ambitious schemes and personal rivalries. I need the aid of all these men. They enjoy the confidence of their several states and sections, and they will strengthen the administration." It was not of himself, but of the best interests of the country that he was constantly thinking. Since his supreme ambition was to give his best service, he sought, in making appointments to his cabinet, the ablest men, and personal feeling did not enter into the matter. Edwin M. Stanton, who had violently abused him during the first part of his administration, he later nominated as Secretary of War. Lincoln apparently never gave Stanton's criticism serious thought, for he believed that Stanton, better than anyone else, could fill that important position. Guided, as always, by impersonal motives, he chose a cabinet among whose members there was not a single personal friend, not one whom he had known for a year. This meant that there was no understanding mind, no friendly heart in which he could confide, and that the burden of his decisions he must carry alone. As many of the cabinet members were men of very much wider experience in public life than the president, it was natural that they should feel superior to him. This was especially true of William H. Seward, Secretary of State, and Salmon P. Chase, Secretary of the Treasury. As a matter of fact, one of the delicate and trying tasks which lay before Mr. Lincoln was to show these two men that they were in reality, as in name, his secretaries, and that he was in reality, as in name, their official chief. Seward was the first of all the cabinet to learn with something of a shock that Lincoln was to be the ruling mind in the new administration. It seems clear that at the start he regarded Lincoln as unfit for his high office, and believed that he himself, as occupying the first place in the cabinet, and as the most powerful leader in the Republican Party, must save the country if it was to be saved at all. Certainly, from his point of view, the president was too ignorant and weak to do it. So, at first, Seward opposed the holding of any cabinet meetings, and the president yielded. Then it was planned to have a meeting on Tuesdays and Fridays, but Seward let it be understood that no member should be present unless he were notified by the president or himself. Thus it would be brought about that only those whom Seward desired would be present, and he would hold the dominating influence. In the meantime, Lincoln was doing his own thinking and reaching his own decisions, some of which were not in accord with those of his Secretary of State, but Seward did not seem to realize this clearly. His belief that Lincoln was incapable of administering the affairs of the nation reached a climax about a month after the inauguration. About April 1st, he suggested in writing that the president allow him to take control of the government in order to save the country. It was a high-handed attitude to assume and a mortal insult to Lincoln. In his letter to the president, Seward said, "We are at the end of a month's administration and are yet without a policy either domestic or foreign." Then, after suggesting some other courses of action which might be followed to advantage, he continued, "But whatever policy we adopt, there must be an energetic prosecution of it. For this purpose, it must be somebody's business to pursue and direct it incessantly. Either the president must do it himself and be all the while active in it, or devolve it upon some member of his cabinet. Once adopted, debates on it must end, and all agree to abide by it. It is not my special province, but I neither seek to evade nor to assume responsibility." It would not be easy to imagine the feelings of the president when he read the outrageous suggestion that he turn over the control of the government to his Secretary of State. If Seward, occupying the first place in the cabinet, and therefore having the best chance to know him, had such an opinion of the weakness of his chief, what must be the views of the other cabinet members? What must be the views of the leaders of public opinion in general? But Lincoln felt no hesitation as to how he should reply to Seward. Although modest, he was never self-distrustful. Even in the troubled days to follow, he had always the strength of a quiet confidence in himself. On the day that Seward's note reached him, he sent his answer. This was tactful, kind, and firm, but there was no doubt as to its meaning. "Upon your closing proposition," he wrote, "that whatever policy we adopt, there must be an energetic prosecution of it. For this purpose, it must be somebody's business to pursue and direct it incessantly. Either the president must do it himself or devolve it on some other member of his cabinet. I remark that if this must be done, I must do it. When a general line of policy is adopted, I apprehend there is no danger of it being changed without good reason, or continuing to be a subject of unnecessary debate. Still, upon points arising in its progress, I wish and suppose I am entitled to have the advice of all the cabinet." In effect, this letter said, "As President of the United States, I have a work to do, and no one else can do it for me." So far has been learned, this affair never reached the ears of any other member of Lincoln's cabinet, or even the most intimate of his friends. Only his private secretary, John G. Nicolay, knew anything about it. It, no doubt, showed Secretary Seward how serious a fault he had committed, and it gave him a new insight into the character of his chief. From that day, he became a loyal and devoted follower of the president, and brought, in unstinted measure, his tireless energy and wide influence to the support of Lincoln. With our knowledge of Lincoln, it is difficult to understand how Seward could have made so stupendous a blunder. but his purpose was patriotic, and he was only a conspicuous example of what many other men in public life thought at that time. That he quickly and completely altered his judgment is shown in a letter written 2 months later to his wife, in which he declared, "Executive force and vigor are rare qualities. The president is the best of us." Immediately after Lincoln became president, an occasion arose when he thought best to make a decision contrary to the advice of those high in office. It concerned Fort Sumter. This fort, which was in Charleston Harbor, was one of the few in the seceded states which the Confederates had not seized in February. A small force of less than 100 men, under the command of Major Anderson, occupied it. The day after his inauguration, March 5th, Lincoln had received a request from Major Anderson for food. There was enough to last only 4 weeks. Lincoln immediately consulted General Scott, who thought it would be impossible, with the means at his command, to comply. Most of the members of his cabinet, including Seward, advised against it. But to Lincoln's mind, there was only one thing to do. The policy of holding or retaking the forts had been plainly set forth in his inaugural, and he did not propose to go back on his word. An expedition with food was sent, and the governor of South Carolina was informed that it carried food alone. This assurance was sent to avoid any possible misunderstanding as to hostile intent, for the president was loath to start an open rupture with the seceded states. The Confederates, however, restless under inaction and determined that Fort Sumter should not be even provisioned, attacked the fort with several thousand troops. Before the Union fleet could arrive in the early morning of April 12th, the firing began and continued for 34 hours. At last the wooden barracks were set on fire by hot shot. The flames spread beyond control. The heat and smoke drove the men in the garrison to lie flat on the ground, with wet cloths on their mouths to keep from suffocating. With food and powder almost gone and flagstaff shot away, the garrison had to surrender. The Confederates, admiring the courage of this handful of men, allowed them to retire from the fort, bearing their arms. Just before leaving, they fired a salute of 50 guns, and marched out with colors flying and the band playing Yankee Doodle. It was thus that the first shots of the Civil War were exchanged. The firing upon Fort Sumter startled the nation. It was the beginning of war, of what might prove to be a long and bloody war. President Lincoln acted with promptness and decision by calling for 75,000 men and appealing to all loyal citizens for support. He declared the South under blockade. For the moment, all differences of opinion were smothered in a great wave of patriotism, and the people of the North, united by a deep desire to preserve the Union, responded to the call of their president with genuine enthusiasm. Money, credit, supplies of all sorts were offered the government. Both North and South began rapidly to organize armies for the bitter conflict which now seemed inevitable. Several slave states, including the border states, refused to respond to Lincoln. Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas seceded. The hostile lines were close to the borders of Washington. There was general alarm. Mothers and children were leaving the city. Mrs. Lincoln was urged to go. "No," she replied, "I am as safe as Mr. Lincoln, and I shall not leave him." Then the troops arrived, and Washington was safe. In their eagerness to attack, the people grew impatient, but the raw troops had to be drilled and made ready. To this task, before July 1st, General McDowell was appointed, being put at the head of the Union army gathered in and about Washington. The Confederate army, under General Beauregard, was stationed around Manassas, near Bull Run, about 35 miles away, within easy striking distance. Daily, the clamor of the North grew stronger for a march to the Confederate capital. "On to Richmond," was the loud outcry of the people. Still, General Scott and other Union generals insisted that the army was not ready. But at last Lincoln, yielding to the urgent demand of the country, ordered that the advance be made. On the day of the Battle of Bull Run, July 21, 1861, McDowell's army at first drove back the Confederates. But during their retreat, word came that the Southern army was reinforced. This news, which came about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, brought panic to the Union army. A stampede followed, which soon became a rout. Men fled for their lives. Teamsters cut their traces and rode away on their horses. Soldiers flung aside their muskets and knapsacks and ran. The army became a mob. Deep gloom settled over Washington that night, for the defeat was a great blow to the Union cause. It fell with cruel severity upon President Lincoln. The early news of the battle had been hopeful, and he was expecting a victory. So, believing that all was going well, he had dropped his work and gone for his afternoon drive. Imagine the shock of receiving on his return the message, "General McDowell's army in full retreat from Centerville. The day is lost. Save Washington and the remnants of this army." It was feared that the Confederates would attack Washington before morning. Through the drizzling rain, crowds of soldiers, Negroes, and terrified horses came fleeing into the city, increasing the horror of the situation. Although the lonely man of the White House suffered keenly in this bitter trial, he remained calm and composed. In the sleepless night following this battle, his busy mind was working out plans by which to retrieve the disaster. With all his heart, he pitied the young, untried soldiers who had failed to stand under the terrible fire of their first battle, and on Tuesday he found time to visit the camp lying south of the Potomac. There he spoke with tender feeling and encouragement to the boys in blue, who 2 days before had fled panic-stricken from the battlefield at Bull Run. This defeat was actually more wholesome for the North than was the victory for the South was overconfident. Many Southern soldiers began to return to their homes as if the war were over, but that was a great mistake. It had only just begun. In the North, the people were nerved in greater energy, for it was clear now that the issue could be settled only by war. The day following the battle, Congress, standing back of the president, voted to raise an army of 500,000 men. Not only did troubles within the country weigh heavily upon the president, but international complications also arose. The Trent Affair was a difficulty coming out of the unwarranted action upon the high seas of a Union Navy officer. The trouble, briefly stated, was this: to secure aid for the Southern cause, two envoys, Mason and Slidell, had been sent by the Confederate government as commissioners to England and France. They eluded the blockade at Charleston and took passage at Havana on the British mail steamer Trent. Captain Wilkes, of the United States war vessel San Jacinto, stopped the Trent off the Bahama Islands November 8, 1861, took off Mason and Slidell, and later confined them in Fort Warren in Boston Harbor. For this act, Captain Wilkes was warmly applauded by the Northern people, who looked upon him as a national hero. The Secretary of the Navy sent him a letter of congratulation. The Secretary of War openly praised him, and the House of Representatives passed a unanimous vote of thanks to him. But England was highly indignant, and at once began to make preparations for war. She sent troops and war vessels to Canada, and with unnecessary earnestness demanded that the prisoners be given up. When the capture of Mason and Slidell was reported to President Lincoln, he at once declared that it did not look right for Captain Wilkes to stop the vessel of a friendly power on the high seas and take out of her by force passengers who went on board in one neutral port to be carried to another. Although he would have liked to uphold Wilkes, Secretary Seward, an expert in international law, reassured him in his first impression by telling him that we had always contended against England for the very principle which had been violated by the captain, and that by refusing to come to a satisfactory agreement with England, we should bring on war with that country. Lincoln, with his strong common sense and his clear ideas of international right and justice, found it easy to reach a wise decision. He gave up the prisoners to England with the statement that Captain Wilkes had acted without the authority of the United States. This was not only high statesmanship, but added greatly to his personal fame. He had the responsibility for these momentous decisions, and he rightly has the credit for them. Throughout the war, he was a master in dealing with complex international affairs. The Trent Affair was but one of the many troubles which gathered thick and fast about Lincoln in his management of the terrible Civil War, and there must have been many times when he longed for a closer companionship in carrying the heavy responsibilities of these distracting first months in the White House, many times when his soul cried out in its loneliness. Then, while public cares were so exacting and public criticism so scorching, Lincoln had also a very heavy personal sorrow to endure. The first winter that he spent in the White House, his two little boys, Willie and Tad, one 10 years old and the other 8, fell ill, and Willie's condition became critical. Daily, the president, leaving his office, spent all the time he could at the bedside of the sick child, and at night he often took the nurse's place. When the end came, the father was almost heartbroken, and his grief was well nigh unbearable. "My poor boy," he murmured, as he stood by the bedside of the dead child, shedding bitter tears. "He was too good for this earth. God has called him home. I know he is much better off in heaven, but we loved him so. It is hard, hard to have him die." But the loss of Willie seemed to make the father cherish more tenderly the little fellow who was left. Tad was with his father much of the time, never hesitating to break in upon him even in the midst of the gravest labors or the most important conferences, sometimes slipping into his father's lap or perching on his shoulder. It is said that at the end of every day Tad came into his father's office, climbed into his father's lap, and told the story of what he had seen and done since early morning. As a rule, he kept on with his childish prattle until he finally fell asleep in his father's arms. Then the president would gently lay him down near his chair and go on with his work. When he had finished, he would gather up the sleeping child in his arms and carry him off to bed. This gives but a glimpse of the tender love that Lincoln had for children, not only his own, but all others. It is said that on one occasion, when there was a reception in the White House, 3 little girls, poorly clad, followed the crowd as they entered the Executive Mansion. Strolling through the building with childish curiosity, they came into the great reception room where the people were greeting the president. They were hurrying through in some confusion when Lincoln observed them. "Aren't you going to shake hands with me, little girls?" he said. Then, to the surprise of all who were present, and to the great delight of the little girls, he stooped over and warmly shook hands with each. Another incident is told which reveals Lincoln's love for children. While on the way to Gettysburg, just before making the Gettysburg Address, at one of the railroad stations, a beautiful little girl handed him through the open window of his car a bunch of rosebuds. As she did so, she lisped, "Flower for the president." Mr. Lincoln, taking the rosebuds and bending over to kiss the child, said gently, "You are a sweet rosebud yourself. I hope you will open into perpetual beauty and goodness." In such simple human ways did the lonely man in the White House find a solace for his sorrows and give expression to that which was finest and noblest in his nature.